This is an ABC podcast.
Here's a tale of two buildings. Well, three actually, but I'll explain that in a moment. They're all in the city of Brisbane, in the Central Business District. The first is the old transit centre, a large mass of concrete and glass and steel, and it's currently being demolished. It's coming down chunk by chunk. I say old, but it was only opened in 1986, so think about it. All the energy and resources that went into building this centre and its adjoining hotel, all of it was expended on a complex that only lasted 34 years. Hello, Anthony Fennell here. Welcome to Future Tense and to a show about efficiency and construction. A sample of some of the new techniques and materials that could make the building industry less wasteful and more environmentally friendly. Okay, now I've moved on a couple of blocks from the transit centre and I'm on Charlotte Street. And this building in front of me here is still under construction. It's going up, not down. It's just had the skin put on, all shiny and new, and it's nearing completion. But it's not what it seems. If you peeled back the outer layer, you'd find the skeletons of two old office towers inside. This complex, known as the Midtown Centre, is actually one big exercise in renewal. Reusability. A good example of how you can extend the lifespan and functionality of old buildings rather than tearing them down. Architect Mark Curzon.
Well, it's a fascinating journey bringing these two buildings together. Interestingly, they're from the 1970s. They were both sort of like 17-storey tall buildings, very square, about 12 metres apart. They were built at the same time, and the opportunity to join those two buildings was almost presented itself by the fact that they were twins. A lot of other buildings don't necessarily have the same attributes where you can join them so seamlessly. So repurposing these wonderful existing buildings was the journey. And a lot of that was around sustainability, the ability to provide large floor plates in the centre of town. And of course, you know, re-skin these buildings and bring them into the modern era and make them breathe and make them flexible and improve the daylight. And, you know, in doing this in the centre of any CBD is quite a challenge. But the proof's probably in the pudding because, of course, it was financially viable and it yielded the fruit that was required to make it a success.
Now, the building join is a full top-to-bottom fusion of the two original towers, isn't it? This isn't a conventional sky bridge between two existing buildings.
No, that's exactly right. This is very much an infill. It's about a 12-metre gap between these two existing towers. So that infill was very much a concrete structure. You know, the floor levels very much aligned with each other. So to infill that slab and to do that, obviously, there was a high degree of structural investigation prior to being able to achieve it. And, you know, some strengthening with columns being reinforced and, of course, beams, etc., and movement joints being carefully located. We were really able to suddenly take two, you know, central core buildings and create this large sort of 1,800 to 2,000 square metre floor plates in the sky.
What were some of the design and engineering challenges involved in making this happen?
There are many, actually. You know, like many things, everything had to do several jobs. So if you start from the structural conditions, you know, we actually had to peel off the existing facade, which was precast panels, to really open up the ability to put full-height glass windows around the building to improve that daylight. The gymnastics of that, of obviously dismantling buildings, was quite a challenge, but a methodology was developed to make that very smooth. The infill was very much a concrete structural solution, which enabled us to create those larger floor plates. And you know, it didn't really just stop there because we actually added an extra six stories on top of the building. So we actually did increase the weight as well. So that reinforcement of columns and key locations in the core were quite integral to enable the building to take the new floor space.
Is this approach rare or are we starting to see more building join projects around the world?
We're definitely starting to see more. There are a number scattered around the planet. There are examples in Sydney, down at Wynyard Place, where Shell House has been actually kept the outside of the building and the inside of the the existing heritage building has got now new floors to line up with a new tower. And there's other buildings as well, big commercial towers where floor plates have been extended, not necessarily joining, but certainly retaining existing cores and floor plates, and then cantilevering new floor space off and beyond. We are seeing a trend around the world where this is happening. I mean, existing buildings are very much, you know, 99% of the built environment. New buildings are not as common as existing buildings. So there really is a huge opportunity. Sustainability, I think, is really important overlay here. We know through studying the building with our consultants that we're maintaining huge percentages of the existing built environment when we do these jobs. And, you know, that converts itself directly into carbon, and basically its reduction of, you know, emissions through these processes are huge. This particular building has been measured at over 230% less impact on its environmental indicators that they would use to measure most buildings with, which equates to about 11,000 tons of carbon emissions. You know, and you can then wrap that into a, you know, carbon-free four-year running periods. So we're starting to see a very strong environmental benefit out of repurposing these existing buildings.
So environmental benefits, but what about the actual cost for the client? Was it more expensive to undertake this kind of approach rather than opting for a full demolition and rebuild?
Well, it's interesting because, of course, programs and length of builds become very much a financial component as well. Having an existing building in place, yes, one approaches it differently. But I think to answer your question, yes, it was very effective to take this approach, because to knock it down was a great deal of time. You have a heritage building at the bottom of the towers as well that you must keep intact. And then, of course, then to rebuild is a length of time as well. And I think the real answer is that financially this was more viable and as viable to achieve those goals, hence why this development pathway, planning pathway, was adopted. And, you know, the result of that is we're so excited to have Rio Tinto being our anchor tenant, taking up to 22,000 square metres. So we're seeing also businesses, I think, like these global corporations, recognise the importance of repurposing buildings as well and being part of that and not just knocking down and rebuilding. Perhaps there's a corporate alignment there as well in some regards.
Mark Curzon, a director at Fender Katsalidis Architects, FKA. So refurbishing and in some cases fusing old residential or business towers has its advantages. But if you want to drive down the environmental impact of construction even further, there's also a need to rethink the types of materials involved. The global cement industry accounts for somewhere between 5 to 8% of global greenhouse gas emissions. So finding an alternative to traditional Portland-style cement, well, that would be a significant innovation. Richard Ryman is a professor of materials science and engineering at Rutgers University, and he's the founder of a materials innovation firm called Solidia.
The way you make a low carbon footprint cement is that you utilize the same process that a cement company utilizes using a rotary furnace, except that we're dropping the temperature of the reaction by 250 degrees Celsius. And what dropping the temperature accomplishes is it reduces the amount of fuel that you're going to use to make the cement. And because you're burning less fuel, you're generating less CO2. Then the other part of the low carbon footprint cement manufacture process is we use less calcium carbonate, or what's called limestone. And by reducing the amount of limestone, you're actually decreasing the amount of energy that's required to make the cement, mainly because the essential part of making any kind of cement, including Portland cement, which is the conventional type of cement, is decomposing the limestone so that it is converted to calcium oxide, which then reacts with what we would either call quartz, silica, or just plain old sand to make a calcium silicate product. So again, you know, it's tied to the fuel, and it's tied because of the lowering of the temperature and using less limestone. And by using less limestone, you're not only reducing the energy because of the energy required to break the carbonate bonds in limestone, but also because you're also using less carbonate. So you're reducing the amount of CO2 simply because you're using less carbonate chemical for your process.
And the particular type of green cement that Professor Ryman has developed has one other advantage. It actually absorbs CO2 during the curing process.
This is very different than the way Portland cement works or the mechanism by which other sustainable cement hardens, because usually people are relying on what's called a hydration bond to create the bonded structure. But in our case, we deliberately make a cement that does not react with water, but only reacts exclusively with CO2. So that not only reduces the amount of greenhouse gases through the consumption of the CO2, but it also reduces the amount of water. So at the end of the day, when you look at all of the CO2 that you have actually eliminated from the process, it comes out to about as much as 70%. And then the amount of water that you can minimize it by is up to 80%. So these are all very big numbers in terms of their significant impact. But all along with the entire process, the key is to develop what we call a drop-in process, meaning you can go to an existing company, use their existing equipment, raw material supply chain, and basically teach them how to use the process rather than tear down an existing facility and build a new one. And that takes away the fear of adoption for the process.
Now, elsewhere in the world, researchers at Western Sydney University have also been experimenting with new forms of eco-friendly cement. Associate Professor Sarah Jung has been focused on what's called MOC, short for magnesium oxychloride cement.
So MOC has been there for quite a long while. It has these advantages, like a very high strength and also faster setting, even fireproofing. But the main disadvantage of this material is the water resistance is very poor. So that means the material, if it's immersed in water or contact with the moisture, the strength will degrade very fast. So that's the main reason actually has been limited the application of this material. So far this material for that reason has been mainly used in indoor as decoration panels or tiles, those kind of thing. Because of the water resistant problem, so they couldn't be widely used as an OPC. So what we have been doing is try to improve the water resistance of this MOC. And then as a result, we can extend the application of this new green cement in the industry application. So what we have been doing is trying to add some other industry product, a byproduct such as the fly ash and the silica fume. So by adding this industry byproduct, and then this material, so improve the water resistance. And at the same time, by using partially this kind of a byproduct from industry, the material is becoming greener.
So how water resistant is your form of MOC?
Our final formula, we did a lot of trials, putting fly ash itself and also putting silica fume itself and then do a combination of a silica fume and the fly ash. So finally, the good result we got, the best result we got is 15% silica fume plus 15% fly ash. And also based on our original formula, we actually got a 100% retain of the compressive strength and the flexural strength. So that means with our formula, after soaking in water for 28 days, we got a 100% retain of the strength.
Now that all sounds promising, and it is, but both Richard Ryman and Sarah Jung say the next hurdle to overcome is addressing the high rate of corrosion that occurs in reinforcing materials when eco-friendly cement is used for concreting. It's a significant problem and helps explain the reluctance of the building industry to embrace the new product.
If you just took any kind of rebar material and you basically reinforced the concrete with it, with Portland cement, it has what we call a very high pH and A pH is just a measure of how many hydroxide ions are in solution. And when you have a lot of them, you have a high pH. A high pH enables the steel to form a passivation layer. So it takes a couple of years with a hydraulic cement before you see any kind of corrosion taking place. And when that happens, the rebar expands and causes cracking in the concrete. Now, in the case of carbonate cement, its pH doesn't change with time, and it sits at a lower pH. So in the presence of aqueous solutions that have plenty of salt in it, the rebar will corrode at a much earlier stage than what you would see with a Portland cement. So what has taken place over the last couple of years is that Solidia has developed its own technology to repress that corrosion. So that's been one approach that they've been very successful in addressing, because that was a significant problem. The other thing, though, is when you look in the civil engineering literature, people are taking a much closer look at other reinforcing materials that could perhaps do an even better job than steel. And some of these technologies are impossible to use in Portland cement because of the high pH. One of them, for example, is glass fiber reinforcement. And another type of reinforcing technology that's up and coming is the use of carbon fiber. So there are a lot of alternatives to address it, whether you use Solidia's proprietary technology or you were to look at alternative fiber technologies.
Richard Ryman. But what if you could reduce the amount of cement and concrete altogether, regardless of how it's made and what it's made of? What if you could build bricks and blocks that used no cement, that were built instead out of, I don't know, well, rubber, for instance?
My name is Justin Chalker, and I'm an associate professor at Flinders University. So our laboratory is broadly interested in sourcing building blocks that are either waste materials or renewable materials. And in this particular instance, we have a new polymeric material made from elemental sulfur, which is a byproduct of the petroleum industry, and it's highly abundant geologically. And then we react that sulfur with a plant oil such as an unsaturated triglyceride. Canola oil is our prototypical example. And this material, because of the sulfur atoms that make up the backbone of this polymer, it has some very unique properties. It allows you to make and reshape and bond this polymer to a variety of different things. So we can make bricks of this rubber-like polymer directly, or we can blend it with a variety of fillers that allow us to impart strength or other desirable properties in construction materials. So one of the valuable things about this material is that, first of all, it's sourced from highly inexpensive and even waste materials. The canola oil can be used cooking oil, and we can make that into these brick-like materials. And because we can add in things like sand or recycled agricultural fibers like coconut coir or other types of plant fibers, or even recycled plastic like PVC shavings, it allows us to tune the properties of this brick in order to tailor it to certain applications. So you could imagine making bricks from this material that would be used for walkways or roads and even construction material for buildings. And we want to think about the large-scale applications because the building blocks for our construction material are highly abundant. Sulfur is virtually unlimited geologically, and canola oil is renewable.
And I understand that this rubber compound, this rubber polymer, can actually then be ground up and reused in an almost endless cycle. Is that correct?
A very interesting property of this material that we've invented is its recyclability. You can mold this material into a quite durable substance, but if you blitz it up or break it, you can actually reform the chemical bonds that hold it together. And that's quite distinct from the vast majority of polymeric materials that we use today. Many of these plastics that we're all familiar with persist in the environment for many years and decades. This material, in contrast, can be generally recyclable. If you look at many of the construction materials that we use today, they can't be reused so easily. And so we think that this is the start of a new advance in the way we think about sourcing and using new construction materials.
As we've heard many times on Future Tense over the years, it's one thing to invent a new form of product or material, but if it's to have impact, it has to be scalable. Justin Chalker again.
We are working with a company to which the IP that covers this technology is assigned, Clean Earth Technologies, based out of Singapore. And that base polymer we can now make on the ton scale. And so they've built a plant in South Australia where we can actually make this material in thousands of kilograms at a time. And that's a key milestone in working towards scalability. And while it's still early days, that is an important step for replacements of concrete, for instance, which otherwise require a very large energy input and are generally harmful to the environment.
We are very used to thinking about, you know, concrete, about brick, about steel. Does it take a bit of a head shift for people to get around the idea that you could perhaps build a concrete substitute using something like this polymer rubber?
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the reasons for that is concrete and steel and traditional bricks are quite useful, and they have a long history in human construction. And in order to shift away to more sustainable materials, it will take time. There's no doubt about that.
I understand that your team has also developed another interesting material, a rubber that can actually repair itself. Could I get you to explain the nature of that?
So once again, this is part of the broader class of materials where we're making new and interesting polymers that are made predominantly from sulfur. And this new rubber, again, made from sulfur and canola oil, has another additive that allows us to tune the flexibility of this rubber. And so we're able to make soft and flexible rubbers all the way to something that's much harder and durable that would be used as a bumper, for instance. And again, this sulfur-sulfur linkage that's found in the backbone of this polymer, you can break and reform it. And for this rubber, we've identified a catalyst that allows us to do that at room temperature. And this is quite important because, say, you have a damaged piece of rubber or you make a device out of this rubber material and you want to repair it. Classically, that's very difficult to do with the way that rubber is currently made. This material, in contrast, you can apply a catalyst to the damaged area and the polymer pieces will join together to form the original polymeric structure with its original strength. And that opens a variety of opportunities in recycling and also additive manufacturing, where you have several smaller components and you're assembling them into a larger piece made from that base rubber.
Justin Chalker from the Institute of Nanoscale Science and Technology at Flinders University in South Australia. You're listening to Future Tense, the Radio National program and podcast exploring the world around us, looking for the pathways ahead and signposting the future. I'm Anthony Fennell. If you have a comment to make about any of our episodes or even if you'd like to suggest a future topic, my name on Twitter is at Anthony J. Fennell.
We love our sunburnt country. It's a land of rich resources, and our richest resource is the sunlight that shines on our wide brown land. Being the sunburned country, we know about the power of the sun. We
were making our final guest today is Anita Ho Bailey, and she's with the School of Physics at the University of Sydney. Professor Ho Bailey has been part of a team experimenting with a crystal material called perovskite. For a long time now, perovskite has been seen as a potential alternative to silicon in the manufacture of solar cells. There's a sense that silicon cells have reached their efficiency limit. Perovskite has many advantages, but until now it's proven far less durable than silicon. But Professor Ho Bailey and her researchers believe they've finally cracked the problem.
This material has got very good optoelectronic properties, so it is able to absorb sunlight very efficiently and you don't need a lot of it. It's cheap in the sense that you only need nanometers of it, so the material usage is low, And also it's cheap in the sense that you only need low temperature for the fabrication of the cells. So you're looking at hundreds of degrees rather than thousands of degrees for silicon cells, where you need a purification for different grades of silicon and also thermal processes for the formation of the semiconductor type devices. And also because you can tune the thickness, you can sort of tune the opaqueness or the transparency of the thin film. And it can be applied on different types of surfaces. So, for example, flexible substrates, and also it's lightweight.
And how does it stack up in terms of efficiency compared to silicon solar cells?
The highest efficiency so far is 25%, and silicon is around 26%. And bear in mind that to get to 26% for silicon, it's taken 40 years to get there. For perovskite, it's only just taken 10 years.
Now, perovskite, people have been experimenting with this for a while, haven't they? One of the problems I understand is that it degrades much faster than silicon, and that's held it back. So yes. What's different about the perovskite that you've developed, or the way that you've used it, the technique? How have you overcome that issue of degradation?
We managed to explain what causes the degradation and how it happens. And we also found ways of stabilizing the perovskite cell so that we have developed some low-cost way of encapsulating the cell, so to stop the moisture from getting into the solar cell, but also to stop the outgassing, what we call, that comes out of the perovskite cell when it's under thermal stress. So it was a very low-cost way of doing it. And what we do is we sandwich the cell between two pieces of glass with a polymer material, and that stops the perovskite from degrading as well. So it does two things, stops the moisture from getting in and stop the perovskite from outgassing. And when we stop the outgassing, we actually stop the chemical reaction that caused the degradation.
So does this mean that the work that you and your colleagues have done on this opens the path to commercialization for this product?
Yeah, because, you know, one of the challenges is, you know, perovskite cell may not be stable enough to last a lifetime of its usefulness. So if you can make it last long, then you can make it more useful. So you produce more energy over the lifetime, and that way it saves the installation cost, because you don't want to have to pull them down and, you know, install them frequently. Once it's up, you want it to stay there for as long as possible and producing electricity for you.
So how long until we see perovskite solar systems operating on houses, say?
Well, they're actually startups, you know, looking at scaling up production. Also, they're startups looking at even combining perovskite with silicon. So it may happen sooner than later. It's very hard to say, because this technology has given us a lot of surprises. So no one has thought that, you know, you can double the efficiency of this technology in 10 years' time. And there are thousands of people working on perovskite cells, and some of them are trying to stabilize it. So it may be rosier than people think. Yeah, it may come out sooner than people think.
Now, you're also experimenting with how to use this material in more creative ways to, for instance, turn windows into solar panels so that you don't need the conventional bulky types on a roof. Is that correct?
Yes, we are looking at opening up the applications of perovskite cells. So it's not just limited to traditional design where you have perovskite module on the roof, but incorporating onto building materials, because it's a thin film material, you can put it on any substrates. So one of the applications we look at is putting perovskite cell in double glazed window, where it has multiple functions, where it's thermal insulating, soundproofing, as well as energy generating.
Putting the windows to work in the name of energy efficiency and hopefully cheaper electricity. Anita Ho-Bailey there from the University of Sydney. We also heard today from Richard Ryman from Rutgers University in the United States, Justin Chalker from Flinders University, Sarah Jung from Western Sydney University, and architect Mark Curzon. There are links on the Future Tense website if you want to explore further. Thanks to my colleague and co-producer, Karin Zsivanovits. You've been listening to Future Tense. I'm Anthony Fennell. Bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.